Welcome to Tears and Tequila Talks, an ongoing discussion series featuring best-selling writers and other experts on the topics of loss, recovery, and personal growth. Today's guest is Anne Hood, author of the best-selling memoir Comfort, A Journey Through Grief, as well as several popular novels, including The Knitting Circle, and most recently, The Obituary Writer. Here are your hosts, Tears and Tequila co-authors Linda Schreier and Joanne Lautman.
Thank you, Anne Hood, for joining us for Tears and Tequila Talks. Joanne Lautman, my co-author, and myself have written a novel called Tears and Tequila that deals with grief and loss. And as such, it seems like a supremely wonderful opportunity to talk with you, Anne, who have written so many beautiful books on this subject and obviously have lived through this deeply yourself. So first of all, I want to thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
And Joanne, you want to introduce yourself?
I'm Joanne Lautman, and I am the founder of Our House and also did a lot of grief work before Our House, both in hospice and in another institution.
Right. It's important work, Joanne.
Thank you. It's kept me going.
Well, our main character, Anne, is a woman who moves to L.A. after the loss of her own family. Her mother left when she was only 5 years old. Her father died. Her grandfather and grandmother, who raised her, died. And she's trying to run from those losses. And she runs 3,000 miles away to Los Angeles, where she gets a job at a funky community center. And accidentally, she backs her way into leading a grief group of widows and widowers her own age. They're in their 30s. And somewhere along the way, she heals her own losses by being a member of that group. So we wondered how you feel there's a commonality between a grief group that is put together for the sake of grief and the group that formed in the Knitting Circle that was sort of an accidental grief group.
Well, you know, I'm someone who is not a very good group person in general. I was kicked out of Girl Scouts, so that was an early sign that I don't play well with others. I tried Compassionate Friends, which I'm sure you know is a group for families who've lost children. And my husband joined first and got so much from these monthly meetings and, in fact, went on to become a facilitator for the local group. But when I went, I felt that a group, I felt erroneously, but it is what I felt at the time, that a group forced to talk about grief and just grief made me feel sadder. I didn't feel helped by it. Whereas sitting around with a bunch of women knitting and slowly having our lives revealed, including, you know, SAT tests, studying for kids, and which camps your kids are going to, and loss and grief and recovery, there was something that felt safer to me. Ironically, I'm the one who ended up becoming active on the national level years later for Compassionate Friends and actually was on the board. And so I think this example, the reason I'm giving it, it speaks to people having to find the right group at the right time. You know, Joanne and I were talking briefly about an initial hesitancy by some people to join grief groups. Some of that is not being ready to talk publicly. Sometimes it has to do, I think, with a cultural upbringing that says, hey, we shouldn't talk about this, or like wear our hearts on our sleeves kind of thing. And I think some of it also has to do with, if I get over this, will I be betraying the person I lost? There's something about holding on to your grief that makes you feel almost like you're doing the right thing. So to me, it's not an either or, it's you find the group, whatever it is, that works for you at the time and can surprise yourself that other kinds of things work later.
I think that's so fascinating. I often say that I grew up in a house of silent mourning because my parents were Holocaust survivors. They had lost their entire families, but nobody talked about it. I didn't really know much about how it works to talk about grief. I'm a writer. I'm not a grief expert. My collaboration with Joanne is what taught me about how people might talk about grief. So I think that this way of saying that people come to their own healing through mourning in their own individual way is really profound. The people in your novel, The Knitting Circle, are so specific. And, you know, Scarlett and Lulu and all the rest of them, are they based on real people or completely from the fictional mind of Anne Hood?
What I did when I began writing the book was, knowing that I wanted to write about the many facets of grief, although my main character has lost a child, I didn't want it to be a book just about women or people who have lost children. So I sat down and thought, what have I learned about grief in these 3 or 4 years and since I lost my daughter? And what is grief? And I just kind of brainstormed and I wrote emotions. And some of them were pretty predictable, like sadness, you know, great sadness. But things I wrote down were like bitterness or guilt. And I was surprised when I wrote emotions like love or hope. And I ended up with about 20, 25 emotions and initially chose 10 and created characters to personify those emotions and then whittled it down to the ones that are in the book. So Scarlett was born out of the emotion of guilt. Harriet, who loses her son in 9/11, was bitterness. Ellen, whose daughter is getting a heart transplant, represented hope. And Beth, who is, you know, dies ultimately of breast cancer, was love, because she loves her husband, she loves her kids. She really has nothing else wrong in her life, but she has this terrible disease. And so they all are personifications of an emotion that I wanted to convey.
Well, that's such an interesting way to go about writing a story. I've never heard that method before.
Well, I didn't want to. In fact, I did a few other things. The woman who taught me to knit was 22 years old. And I didn't want for a minute to have anyone think the character who teaches Mary to knit is this wonderful young woman, Jen. That's why I made her so much older, so that there's no confusion.
Right.
So there's a lot going on that I did not want real people in the book, including the character of Mary, who is not me. But, you know, people always think she is, and I get very funny emails sometimes asking how this or that is going, my job at the newspaper and things like that. She's not me, and the way I ensured she wasn't me is that I had her lose her only child, because once I landed on that, her story was very different than mine.
Joanne and I did similar things. The main character in our story is not her, it's not me, it's some sort of combination of the two of us,
yeah.
And all of the grievers and the grief groups are not actual people.
Absolutely, and that's the sort of wonderful or wonder and sadness that's associated with writing about grief, I think, is that it is universal. And no matter how long ago the wisdom was given, you know, there are still people learning from it. I mean, one of the books that I return to is C.S. Lewis's A Grief Observed, about his wife dying. There was a line in there that I still sometimes will write down to myself or write as a Facebook status, or because it was the most true thing I read when Grace died, which is, her absence is like the sky. It covers everything. He wrote that a very long time ago, but to me it's so real and present.
I saw that line recently. I don't know if it was on your Facebook page or someone quoting C.S. Lewis. It's such a perfect line.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you about something else. We talked previously with Abigail Carter. She lost her husband in 9/11, and she wrote a book called The Alchemy of Loss. And when we talked to her, we talked about the concept of an unintentional life. She talks about that, the life that came after her loss. And I know that that life can apply to all of us, whether we've lost a child or a spouse or a parent or any other kind of loss we've had. If we've been divorced or we've moved away from our family. You yourself have lived an unintentional life after Grace died. And I wondered if you would want to talk about that a bit, about the value of that. We obviously know that was not something that you wanted to have happen. But is there any kind of value of living an unintentional life?
Well, I think it's the most valuable thing you can do after loss, really, because all of us feel with enormous loss that you can't go on. I mean, you hear people say that, but of course you do go on. And by going on, you're living an unintentional life, because the person that you are when you've had that loss, a little bit of that person, or maybe a lot of that person, dies too. And I think part of moving through grief is reinventing yourself. I don't mean changing your hair color or, you know, becoming a hula dancer. I mean reinventing from the inside out, because your role stopped with that loss. I was no longer the mother of a five-year-old daughter. And so one of the hardest things, I think, about a grief journey is figuring out, if you're not that person, then who are you now? And so there's always, you know, that before and after for anyone who I think suffers grief. I stopped writing when Grace died. And so for several years, I was a writer who wasn't writing. And although I wasn't happy with that, although it added to my feelings of grief, I have to say that by not writing, it helped me be open to all the new the things coming my way that I couldn't imagine, you know, including writing a book like The Knitting Circle and writing my memoir, Comfort, A Journey Through Grief, both books that have gone on to touch so many people who've had loss. But I think without that pause in my writing life, I don't think I would have been able to move forward enough to write those. And of course, we went on to adopt an amazing little girl from China, our daughter Annabelle, who's now 10, and she's actually floating around this room where I'm sitting.
Hi!
Hi, Annabelle. I read about you a lot.
The star of my Facebook page. She gets more likes than anything else I put up there. But anyway, so, you know, that was something we hadn't imagined, that there would be another child in our lives. And it's been the most remarkable thing of the past 10 years.
Yeah, that's a wonderful definition of the unintentional life.
I think so.
Abigail Carter said that it made her much less afraid to take risks and much more willing to just, you know, it was sort of like the worst had happened. Would you agree?
Absolutely. And I do think I would have to agree with, you know, in a way you say the worst thing you can imagine happened. I mean, I can imagine worse, many things worse, but the worst thing so far that's happened, you know, there's this book, The Wave, about the woman who's lost her whole family, her parents, her kids.
Yes.
Tsunami. And you read a book like that, and I wonder, as you were talking, what's her unintentional life now? There will be one. We know that. You know, everybody who's come through something understands that somehow life comes to you. It just, you don't know when or what.
Well, that's it. Right. And as you said, you didn't write for years afterwards.
Right.
And you had to be, I think that was probably the chrysalis that you had to emerge from to become a new person.
Yeah. I mean, one of the funniest things is becoming a knitter, because I always say that if they voted for things like, you know, how you get most likely to succeed in that, I would be most likely to not knit. And one of the wonderful gifts I was given was learning to knit and the ability to have this thing in my life that calms me and becomes meditative and helps me wait for airplanes and all sorts of wonderful benefits. So I have to say that part of that unintentional life has been this gift of something I never thought to explore.
Fantastic. Joanne, did you see that in any of the grievers that you worked with about how they reinvented themselves?
Yeah, I'm thinking about myself, and I never expected to start a grief agency or to find that to be my mission in life.
And people in the groups, they all changed, and then they wanted permission from the group. Was it okay that they were trying something new? Had they, that they had changed?
I think there's almost a natural instinct or tendency to want to keep the life you had, even though there's this enormous change in it. A friend of mine tells the story about when his wife was alive, he went home at 5 o'clock every day. They had a martini together. They cooked dinner together and they ate together. And after she died, he would go home at 5 o'clock and just get, you know, sink deeper into grief. And it took months before he realized, don't go home at 5 o'clock. You know, that routine is not there. And it's making you feel worse because you're sitting there saying, we should be doing this. We would be doing that. So he started working later, going out with friends from work afterwards, eating dinner later, you know, at changing that routine. But it took, he was very resistant to it for months because it was one more piece of evidence that in fact his wife had died and that he was going on alone. And I think that's what people feel guilty, you know?
Yeah, it's a kind of putting yourself first.
It is. I mean, one of the things, and I thought about this a lot when I was writing The Knitting Circle, is people in active grief are selfish. They need to be selfish. And making sure that I presented a character, Mary, the main character, as someone who was selfish in the way grieving people are, but wasn't unlikable. You know what I mean? And my editor and agent were very quick to tell me when I crossed the line into, well, I know grieving people might be selfish, but she's going too far, or, you know, we're not liking her. Can you pull it back a little? But I think there is a need for that in order to find the comfort you need.
I couldn't agree with you more that the book Tears and Tequila deals with grief and loss. There's a great deal more to our story than the grief group, however, and it is the lives of other people and especially the main character who heals her own losses. And she's not a member of the grief group. She's the facilitator, the accidental facilitator. So I think that my last question would be about the universality of loss. Mm. And your books appeal to people who haven't lost anyone, actually. I mean, Everyone loses someone, but I'm sure you've heard from readers.
Yeah. One of the examples of that I'll never forget, I was doing an enormous book signing at the New England Knitters Guild. I don't know, there might have been 1,000 people there. There were so many, and I signed books for a long time, and I heard many, many stories of profound loss. And then a woman came up to me. She was maybe 60 years old. She was crying so hard, I had her sit down next to me. And her loss was not the loss of a person or the kind of losses the other people had been talking about who were telling me their stories. She had married a man who was 15 years older than her, and he had retired and wanted to move to Arizona to one of these retirement communities. And she at the time was only in her late 50s. She had an active life, a part-time job at a hospital that she loved, many friends, a bridge club. She had grandchildren in the next town and a home that she just loved. She loved her garden. She liked her life. But he was ready to move to this, you know, warmer climate and near a golf course and all of that. And so she did it because she was of the generation that, you know, you kind of do what your husband wants. And it had been 8 months and she was positively grieving, you know, and she said the Knitting Circle had changed her life. Now, she hadn't lost a person. She had healthy children, healthy grandchildren. Her husband was healthy. But she had lost everything that she loved about her life. She was thousands of miles from her grandchildren. She couldn't have a garden because of the weather in Arizona, not the gardens she was used to. She hadn't found a new bridge club. She didn't know what to do with her time. Her husband was on the golf course. She was lonely and confused. And here she was 60 years old having to reshape her life, not unlike other losses, you know? And at first I was like, I've just been listening to stories of people who've lost their children and their spouses, you know, but I looked in this woman's eyes and I realized loss and grief are universal. She was in active grief. You know, I put my arms around her and told her, just like I would if someone had told me about losing someone, it'll get better. You have to think about what you can do in the new place you are, you know, all the things we tell people. And they certainly applied to her. And this was not a woman who was superficial in any way. She had really deep feelings of loss. You know, what is that saying? You know, if you've lost your job, your home, you know, there's a list of things in a year that you're suffering grief. And she had lost many of those things. I think it's important to recognize that, you know, people suffer all kinds of losses. I mean, we're all walking around. It's amazing that we can put our pants on every day and smile and, you know, look at each other. But that's part of the wonder of this journey we're on.
Yeah, well, I agree with you, and I'm sure, Joanne, you agree too. I wanted to thank you, Anne, for talking with us. We have a lot to share with you, and we have a lot to admire about you and the way in which you healed your loss and the way in which you continue to do so and the wonderful and exquisite way you have with words. I, as a writer and a writing teacher, you are one of my heroines.
Oh, thank you so much. That's lovely. Thank you. And good luck with the book. And thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me.
Tears and Tequila Talks is hosted by Linda Schreier and Joanne Lautman. For more on the Tears and Tequila Talks series, or to learn more about the book Tears and Tequila, visit www.tearsandtequila.com.